Welcome to the Deep Dive. I'm Lee Graham, your guide, ready to really cut through the noise and get to the heart of today's biggest stories.
And I'm Sam Hurst. It's great to be here, especially with the paper we've got in front of us today.
Absolutely. We are diving deep into the Washington Post for Friday, September 5th, 2025. And wow, it's packed.
It really is. High-stakes politics, major economic shifts, those critical health debates we keep seeing, national security changes, it's all in here.
Plus, local D.C. issues that, frankly, have national implications. Mm-hmm. So our mission today is to navigate all this, pull out the most important insights, and really understand what it means for you.
Yeah, we're talking about everything from, you know, the integrity of financial institutions all the way to global alliances, and even some really interesting personal relationship advice.
It could be quite the journey. Okay, let's unpack this. So let's kick things off right where executive power meets, or maybe clashes with, institutional independence. We're talking about the Federal Reserve.
A foundational institution. And this first story, it's definitely sending some shockwaves through Washington.
Okay. The Post reports the Justice Department has opened a criminal mortgage fraud investigation into Federal Reserve Board member Lisa Cook. This feels like more than just a standard inquiry, doesn't it?
You're right. It's not your typical investigation at all. It really looks like a significant escalation in the Trump administration's, well, ongoing efforts to remove Cook from the Fed's board.
Right.
And the investigation itself. It stems from a criminal referral by Bill Pult. He's the director of the Federal Housing Finance Agency.
Okay.
And he's accusing Cook of making false statements on mortgage applications, homes in Michigan and Georgia.
Hmm. And who's overseeing this probe? Because that often tells a story.
It certainly does here. It's Ed Martin. He's the director of the Justice Department's Weaponization Working Group.
Okay, the Weaponization Working Group. What exactly is that, and why is its involvement, you know, significant here?
Well, the administration claims its job is to look into potential abuses of government power. But critics, they argue it's basically being used to investigate political opponents.
Right. We've seen that name pop up before.
Exactly. It's investigated others seen as Trump's foes, Senator Adam Schiff, New York AG Letitia James.
So its involvement here, well, it suggests a pattern, doesn't it? Using legal channels for what look like political ends. Targeting specific people.
And Cook herself. She's not taking this lying down, is she?
No, not at all. She's called the attempt to fire her unprecedented and illegal. Her lawyers are denying any fraud, saying the homes might have just been mislabeled on the applications.
Okay, so there's the legal fight. But beyond that, what's the sort of immediate critical threat this poses to the economy, to, you know, average Americans?
Well, the key thing here, the real insight, isn't just about a potential interest rate change, though that's part of it. It's the erosion of the Fed's independence.
That freedom from political pressure, it's absolutely critical for stable interest rates, for controlling inflation. If they manage to fire Cook, it could give Trump allies a majority on the 7-member Fed board.
A majority, wow.
And that could totally change future interest rate decisions. It could even, because of a sort of legal quirk, allow them to replace all 12 regional Fed presidents early next year.
So this directly affects, well, your mortgage costs, your investments, the whole economic picture.
Exactly. It threatens the stability of your economic future, regardless of how the specific investigation turns out. Just the process itself creates this chilling effect.
And Cook's position at the next Fed meeting, September 16th, she's kind of stuck, isn't she?
Completely stuck. If she opposes a rate cut, which Chair Jerome Powell has hinted is coming, people might say it's political retaliation against Trump.
Right.
But if she supports it, she could be seen as caving to the pressure. It's a public no-win situation for her. It just highlights the intense political heat.
We've seen some political reaction to...
Yeah. Representative Ro Khanna urged her to just release her mortgage records, trying to emphasize the political motivation behind it all. And Senator Tom Tillis, a Republican, said he won't support confirming any replacement until Cook's lawsuit is resolved. That gives her a bit of a shield, maybe temporarily.
It really underscores this isn't just about one person. It's a fundamental challenge to a key institution.
It is, and it impacts all of us.
And, you know, that same kind of battle, this time over scientific independence and, crucially, public trust. Well, it's playing out very intensely over at the CDC. So Health and Human Services Secretary Robert F. Kennedy Jr. was recently before the Senate Finance Committee. He was defending his tenure, which has been pretty tumultuous, hasn't it? Chaos at the CDC, confusion over new COVID vaccine rollouts. What came out of that hearing?
We saw really stark contrasts. Kennedy used the time to, you know, talk up agency achievements, things like action on artificial food dyes, drug prices, fighting healthcare fraud. But then he launched this really scathing attack on the CDC itself, called it a failure during COVID, said it pushed nonsensical policies.
That kind of policies.
He claimed they destroyed small businesses, violated civil liberties, closed our schools, masked infants with no science, and heightened economic inequality. Really strong words.
And he specifically mentioned firing the CDC director.
Yes, Susan Monares.
Yeah.
He fired her, and that led three senior officials to resign in protest. Monares, remember, was only confirmed back in July.
Right, very recent.
And she actually wrote an op-ed saying she was pressured to fire staff and basically pre-approve recommendations from a new vaccine advisory panel.
And what was the issue with that panel?
Well, Monares said it was filled with people expressing, quote, anti-vaccine rhetoric.
And Kennedy himself seems to agree with those critical views on vaccines.
Largely, yes. He expressed agreement with one of his appointees, Retsef Levi, who stated that mRNA vaccines cause serious harm, even death, especially in young people.
Wow. Did he acknowledge any benefit?
He did concede vaccines saved quite a few lives, but he specifically avoided saying millions, which is, you know, a notable choice of words.
So what are the bigger implications here for public health in the U.S.?
I think the core insight, Lee, is a really profound erosion of the public health system and, just as importantly, public trust.
How so?
Deborah Howery, the former CDC chief medical officer who resigned over this, she laid out some really grave concerns. Proposed deep cuts to funding for chronic disease prevention, think tobacco control, blood pressure programs.
Things that save lives long term.
Exactly. And a severe weakening of public health data collection, the lab infrastructure. Flu sample submissions down 70%. COVID data down 60%. Polio lab submissions just stopped entirely.
That sounds dangerous.
She also mentioned 750 fewer ready responders for a crisis. These changes fundamentally weaken our ability to track health threats, to respond effectively when the next thing hits.
And the impact on public trust, you mentioned that too.
Yeah, Howery's account paints this picture of just a severe breakdown in transparency. CDC guidance changes announced on social media platform X, not through official channels, unvetted presentations at advisory meetings, fabricated references and reports, even the MMWR, the Morbidity and Mortality Weekly Report, a cornerstone publication, was paused without explanation.
So people don't know what to believe.
Precisely. These actions just undermine the public's trust in science-based guidance. It makes it harder for you, for your community, to make informed health decisions. And this isn't just happening at the federal level. It's driving this wedge between states now.
So if I'm a parent listening, does this mean my kids' vaccine requirements or even just the health advice I get could be totally different depending on which state I live in?
That's exactly what's happening. It's a clear example of how politicizing science breaks down national health standards. You've got Washington, Oregon, California forming their own coalition for vaccine recommendations, countering federal actions. Meanwhile, Florida announced plans to end all school vaccine mandates. Measles, polio, everything, though, that needs legislative approval. Other states, like New Mexico, Massachusetts, they're making their own rules about vaccine access in pharmacies.
It's a real patchwork.
It's a fractured public health landscape,
and
it has real-world consequences for every American, for your family's health choices, your peace of mind.
That is a stark reminder. Okay, from these internal battles over institutions, let's broaden the view now to geopolitical shifts. Specifically, how the administration is rethinking some longstanding alliances and security commitments. This sounds like a really major pivot, Sam. The Post reports the Trump administration plans to suspend European security programs, ones designed specifically to deter Russia. What's the thinking here, and which programs are getting cut?
It is a significant strategic shift. David Baker, who heads Europe and NATO policy at the Pentagon, basically told European defense officials the decision comes down to shifting U.S. priority.
Priority shifting towards?
Towards deterring China more aggressively in the Pacific and also increasing focus on border security and homeland defense here in the U.S.
Okay. And the program's being suspended.
A key one is the Baltic Security Initiative. That's been crucial since 2018 for reinforcing Estonia, Lithuania, and Latvia, building up military infrastructure, training. It's almost doubled in size, actually.
And vital for them, I imagine.
Absolutely. For these smaller economies, it's vital. It's seen as a symbolic show of U.S. support, a deterrent against potential Russian aggression. Lawrence Speranza at SIPA called it exactly that.
Now, I thought Congress had approved funding for this, specifically the Senate Appropriations Committee, something like $225 million for the Baltics Initiative. Can the administration just redirect that?
Well, yes, they can, through something called reprogramming. It allows the Pentagon, under certain conditions, to shift smaller amounts of money around without specific congressional approval for each move. And this seems to be part of a bigger picture, a global force posture review led by Elbridge Colby at the Pentagon. It's widely expected that review will lead to a smaller U.S. military footprint in Europe overall.
But didn't Trump say something different to Poland?
He did. That's the sort of nuance here. He apparently told Poland's president the U.S. would not remove troops from Poland, maybe even add more. So it's perhaps not a uniform withdrawal picture.
Interesting. So what are the bigger implications of these cuts, especially for the Baltics? And how's Congress reacting?
Well, the core insight, I think, is the potential weakening of European security and maybe even a fragmentation of the Western alliance. These cuts could leave the Baltic nations feeling much more vulnerable, even though they spend a high percentage of their GDP on defense.
Right. U.S. presence is key.
It's a critical deterrent. Undermining that could undermine NATO's collective defense. And lawmakers, yes, from both parties, are already raising concerns. They worry the administration isn't spending money the way Congress legislated, that the Pentagon could just redirect funds without proper oversight.
So Congress might try to step in.
They might try to protect these programs in the National Defense Authorization Act, the NDAA. But the signal it sends globally is significant. For you listening, shifts in these global alliances and defense strategies, they can indirectly affect your safety, international stability, even economic relationships through trade and supply chains.
It really shows how interconnected everything is. And speaking of domestic impacts, let's turn to the deployment of military forces right here in the U.S., specifically in D.C. Okay, so the D.C. Attorney General, Brian Schwalb, has filed a lawsuit. He wants to stop the Trump administration's deployment of the National Guard in D.C. This is actually the second lawsuit like this since Trump declared a crime emergency back in August. What's Schwalb's main argument?
This looks like a major constitutional fight brewing, Lee. Schwalb is arguing that having armed troops patrolling the city is harmful to residents and that deploying them involuntarily infringes on D.C.'s already limited autonomy.
And he's citing a specific law.
Yes, the Posse Comitatus Act. That's the law that generally bars the military from being used for domestic law enforcement. He's saying this deployment violates that.
And this deployment is part of a bigger picture.
Right. It's part of this broader crackdown that includes trying to control D.C. police, federal officers arresting undocumented immigrants, seizing guns, evicting homeless people. Similar deployments are actually facing legal challenges out in California, too.
Though D.C.'s situation is unique.
Exactly. D.C.'s unique status makes this case different.
So how's the White House defending the deployment?
Abigail Jackson, a White House spokeswoman, says it's completely within Trump's authority, protecting federal assets, assisting law enforcement. She basically framed the lawsuit as just another attempt to undermine the president's efforts to stop crime in D.C.
And that California case you mentioned.
Yeah, a federal judge there, Charles R. Breyer, did rule that the administration illegally used guard troops during immigration raid protests, violating Posse Comitatus. But again, because D.C. isn't a state and lacks full home rule, that ruling doesn't directly apply here.
So what's the fundamental legal question this D.C. case hinges on?
The core insight here is that this case is really testing the limits of presidential power and, crucially, the unique status of D.C.'s National Guard. The key legal question, and it's never actually been fully settled by the courts, is this. Is the D.C. National Guard considered a state militia, like in other states? Or is it inherently federal because it's under federal command and therefore subject to Posse Comitatus?
That's a huge distinction.
It is. Elizabeth Goitein at the Brennan Center pointed out that under the Justice Department's interpretation, a president could essentially use the D.C. Guard as his own personal police force. That raises serious civil liberties concerns for everyone.
So this isn't just a local D.C. squabble?
Not at all. It's about the balance of power between federal and local government, the role of the military in your daily life, and fundamental civil liberties.
That balance is so critical. And right alongside this, we're seeing some really intense judicial pushback against these executive actions. Sam, there's this story about a federal magistrate judge in D.C., Zia M. Faruqi. He absolutely blasted the Trump administration's policing surge in the city, accused officials of trampling people's rights by essentially overcharging defendants. This sounds like a direct confrontation.
It's incredibly direct. Judge Faruqi used terms like constitutional crisis. He said they were playing cops and robbers while the rule of law is being flushed down the toilet. Really strong language from the bench.
Yeah.
He made it clear federal judges will keep pushing back on what he called implausible, illegal, immoral prosecutions. Especially, he noted, when people are hit with felony charges for weak cases that eventually get dismissed, but only after they've spent time in jail.
And the U.S. attorney, Jeanine Pirro, she responded.
Oh, yes, forcefully. She accused Faruqi of letting his politics cloud his judgment, of justifying felons carrying firearms, pushing for the release of dangerous criminals. She defended her office's approach of seeking the toughest possible charges.
So it's a real clash. What kind of cases are highlighting this disagreement?
We're seeing a pattern emerge. There's the case of Simeon Fontaine, charged with a felony for firearm possession after being found unconscious in a car. Case dismissed. Why? The gun was legally owned by someone else, and he didn't even know it was there.
Okay.
Then Torres Riley charged after police searched his bag for a heavy object. Judge Faruqi called it the most illegal search I've seen in my life. Case dismissed.
And it's not just dismissals, but grand juries too.
Right. Grand juries have refused to indict 7 times since this search started. People like Alvin Summers, Natalie Rose Jones facing felony charges for assault or threats against Trump, the grand juries declined to indict. The judiciary is clearly sending signals about overreach.
And Judge Faruqi even threatened further action.
He did. Threatened that judges might stop signing complaints altogether or start calling police officers to the stand to get exculpatory information up front.
So what's the big takeaway from this judicial resistance?
The core insight is this direct clash over due process and the rule of law. You're seeing the judiciary acting as a really vital check on what it perceives as executive overreach.
Mm-hmm.
And this practice of overcharging and then dropping cases, it erodes public trust in the justice system, it causes unnecessary detention, and it puts immense strain on resources like the DC Public Defender's Office, which says it's stretched to the point of exhaustion.
So for our listeners,
for you, this is about the fundamental rights and legal protections you expect. It shows how those rights can be challenged when law enforcement actions seem politically motivated or just excessive.
That's a powerful demonstration of checks and balances. And this pattern of the administration targeting perceived opponents, it seems to extend even to former high-ranking officials like John Bolton. So the FBI recently searched the home and office of former National Security Advisor John Bolton. They seized computers, phones, documents, including, interestingly, folders labeled Trump IAV. What's the official reason for the search, then?
Well, the search warrants, which the Post reviewed, confirm that prosecutors are building a case against Bolton. The allegations are serious. Unauthorized removal of classified documents and potential Espionage Act violations related to national defense information.
Espionage Act. That carries heavy penalties.
It does. Maximum of 10 years in prison. The warrants allowed agents to seize anything that appeared to be classified or was related to his time as National Security Advisor from 2018 to 2019.
Did they find classified documents?
The records don't explicitly say if documents with actual classified markings were found, but the scope of what they took, computers, phones, USB drives, suggests a very thorough investigation is underway.
Now, Bolton's lawyer is pushing back hard, calling this politically motivated, saying it's the Justice Department acting under pressure to satisfy a president sitting political revenge. Does this fit the pattern we've been discussing?
It absolutely seems to align with that pattern, Lee. Bolton is just the latest in this line of Trump's political critics or former associates who have faced criminal investigations. We've seen it with Senator Adam Schiff, James Comey, John Brennan, Letitia James.
Right.
And remember, the Justice Department even investigated Bolton before over his 2020 book, The Room Where It Happened, looking into whether he revealed classified material. No charges came from that then. This current probe seems to include concerns about the book, but also newer allegations.
Has the administration commented on the political motivation charge?
Vice President J.D. Vance denied it's political. He said, quote, "You should let the law drive these determinations."
Okay, so stepping back, what's the core insight we should take from these recurring investigations of former officials and critics?
I think the core insight is this growing concern about the potential weaponization of the Justice Department. This pattern really forces us to ask serious questions about political motivations behind these investigations.
Mm-hmm.
It also highlights this constant tension, doesn't it, between a former official's right to their own records and the government's absolute need to protect classified information.
And what about free speech?
That's a big part of it, too. Does this chill dissent? Can former officials speak critically about an administration without fearing legal reprisal? And how does that affect the information that gets the public to you? It's about the balance between accountability and preventing political targeting and what that means for the integrity of your government.
That integrity is so fundamental. Now, let's shift focus slightly to how these political shifts and decisions are actually impacting the federal workforce and the day-to-day functioning of government agencies. This next story details something quite unusual. The Trump administration is apparently reassigning federal staff into roles they often have little or no experience in, often, it seems, to fill gaps left by firings or resignations. Sam, can you give some examples of these moves and what the administration's agenda seems to be?
Yeah, we're seeing how these reassignments are being used quite strategically to align agencies with administration priorities. For example, FEMA employees reassigned to IC to help with deportation efforts. Justice Department attorneys moved to a new Sanctuary Cities Enforcement Working Group. And a lot of these moves specifically target civil rights work. You have Justice Department lawyers who used to protect employees from discrimination now doing HR tasks or handling FOIA requests. HUD civil rights lawyers shifted to defending the agency in lawsuits. A Transportation Department employee with a decade in civil rights is now reviewing highway grants. It clearly reflects a policy shift being enacted through personnel changes.
How are the employees themselves reacting, being moved into jobs they're not trained for?
Well, reports suggest work is becoming less efficient, and many employees feel it's an effort to get us to just quit and abandon ship, as one HUD attorney, Paul Osadedi, put it. Now, some employees do accept the new roles, maybe preferring it to looking for a new job. They keep their pay level, interestingly. So you might have highly paid employees now doing jobs typically associated with lower pay grades.
And the official line from the White House.
White House spokesman Davis Engel stated Trump is committed to making our government as efficient and effective as possible, adding that everyone serves at the pleasure of the president, basically implying these moves are within presidential authority and aimed at efficiency. Although over 154,000 federal workers have volunteered to leave but are still on the payroll, which indicates significant disruption.
So what's the core insight here? What are the broader impacts of shuffling people around like this, especially regarding institutional knowledge and the services people rely on?
The core insight is a really concerning erosion of institutional knowledge and expertise. One former IT worker at the Social Security Administration described it as strategic decapitation of institutional knowledge.
Strong words.
They are. And it leads to less efficient work, potentially degrading the quality of public services across the board. By moving experienced staff out of specialized roles, the administration can effectively change an agency's focus without needing Congress to pass new laws. This seems particularly aimed at areas like civil rights enforcement.
So for our listeners.
For you, these changes inside federal agencies can directly impact the quality, the efficiency of public services. You depend on everything from emergency response like FEMA to getting your Social Security benefits processed correctly.
That's a very tangible impact.
Yeah.
And in a similar vein, kind of at the intersection of politics and institutional norms, there's this story about a military rank being restored. Okay, this one definitely raises some eyebrows.
Yeah.
The U.S. Navy has restored the retired rank of Representative Ronnie Jackson, you know, the former White House physician, a very strong Trump ally, from captain back to rear admiral. This reverses a demotion that happened during the Biden administration. What's the backstory here, Sam?
Yeah, this has a very clear political feel to it. Jackson was demoted back in 2022. That followed a Pentagon Inspector General report, which upheld allegations of misconduct against him. Things like bullying staff, making inappropriate sexual comments.
Okay.
But now, the Navy Secretary, John Phelan, who was appointed by Trump, has reinstated the rank. He cited good cause to reopen the original determination.
And Jackson himself had sort of ignored the demotion.
He had. He famously refused to acknowledge it publicly, kept calling himself Rear Admiral. And these demotions, they're not just symbolic. They carry real financial consequences, like a reduced pension and definitely a social stigma within the military.
How are Democrats reacting to this reversal?
They're criticizing it pretty strongly, calling it a subversion of the military's process. Chris Meagher, a Democratic strategist, said it shows loyalty to power is more valuable than integrity in uniform.
So what's the core issue here? What insight should we draw from this?
I think the core insight is the concern about the politicization of military justice. It raises questions about whether political influence is overriding standard military procedures for conduct and discipline. And that potentially impacts military integrity overall.
So for the listener.
For you, it touches on the importance of integrity in public service, especially in the military, and what it means for your trust in those institutions when decisions look like they might be politically motivated rather than based purely on established roles and conduct.
It's a tricky line to walk, isn't it?
Mm-hmm.
Okay, shifting from these internal political decisions, let's look at a major economic policy with global reach tariffs. The Trump administration is going to the Supreme Court. They want the justices to quickly overturn a lower court ruling that struck down most of those sweeping tariffs on goods from, well, dozens of countries. Sam, the Solicitor General, D. John Sauer, is pushing for a decision by September 10th. Why the rush? What's really at stake here?
The urgency definitely signals how high the stakes are, Lee. Sauer mentioned economic prosperity, national defense. He wants oral arguments scheduled for early November. This could be a really huge case, testing a central piece of the president's economic agenda.
And the lower court ruling, what did it say?
A federal appeals court, the Court of Appeals for the Federal Circuit, ruled 7-4 that Trump didn't actually have the authority under the 1977 International Emergency Economic Powers Act, that's IEPA, to impose these tariffs. They found the law just doesn't explicitly grant the power to impose taxes or tariffs. And Trump is the first president ever to use this nearly 50-year-old law specifically for tariffs. It's a novel use of executive power.
And these tariffs, remind us, they're pretty broad.
Oh, very broad. We're talking 10 to 25% on goods from China, Mexico, Canada, supposedly for failing to stop fentanyl flow. But beyond that, there's the universal 10% import tax on all trading partners, with even higher rates on about 60 countries. Trump called these the Liberation Day tariffs.
Right, and businesses have already challenged these.
Yes, small businesses, even states, filed lawsuits arguing they were illegal from the start.
So if the Supreme Court agrees to hear this, what's the core insight we should be looking for?
The core insight here is this major test of presidential power versus congressional authority, specifically the power to tax.
Mm-hmm.
A Supreme Court decision could have massive impacts on the U.S. economy, on global trade, and critically on consumers, on you, because tariffs ultimately mean higher prices. Constitutionally, this is a fundamental question. Can the executive branch impose taxes without clear delegation from Congress? A ruling against Trump would gut a huge part of his economic agenda. A ruling for him would grant presidents significant new power.
So it really affects the prices you pay, the competitiveness of your businesses, your whole economic future.
Absolutely. It's a case with profound implications for everyone.
That's a massive potential shift. Okay, let's transition now into our second major part, where we'll explore some global connections and interesting cultural moments from today's post. All right, we're shifting from those high-stakes domestic policy battles to the really complex arena of international relations. First up, we see the Trump administration apparently struggling with conflicting efforts to mend ties with a really crucial global player, India. The Post is reporting that the U.S.-India relationship is maybe at its lowest point in decades, and a big reason seems to be escalating anti-India rhetoric from President Trump himself, and especially from his top economic advisor, Peter Navarro. Sam, what kind of things has Navarro been saying? And how is this messing up diplomatic efforts?
Yeah, there seems to be a real disconnect within the administration here, Lee. Navarro has been particularly inflammatory. He's called the Russia-Ukraine conflict Modi's war. He's branded India a laundromat for the Kremlin, basically accusing them of helping Russia evade Western oil sanctions.
Yeah.
He even suggested on Fox News that Indian Brahmins are profiteering from the Ukraine conflict, really church language.
And meanwhile, others in the administration are trying to do what?
Well, Secretary of State Marco Rubio and U.S. Trade Representative Jameson Greer apparently tried to present Trump with a proposed trade deal with India. It included significant tariff cuts by India.
Okay, that sounds positive.
But Trump rejected it. Demanded India first scale back its purchases of Russian oil, and then he went on Truth Social and called the U.S.-India economic relationship a totally one-sided disaster. So very mixed signals.
Right. Tough to negotiate under those conditions.
Yeah.
How has India's Prime Minister Narendra Modi reacted to all this?
Modi's response has been quite striking. He's adopted this posture of, well, defiance. He's been actively courting Russia and China. Attended the Shanghai Cooperation Organization summit with Xi Jinping and Vladimir Putin, emphasizing their development partners and not rivals.
That signals a potential shift in alignment.
It really could. Modi has also said he's willing to pay a heavy price rather than accept a U.S. trade deal he feels would hurt Indian workers. And tensions got even worse after that military clash between India and Pakistan. Trump claimed credit for brokering a ceasefire. India denied it, and that apparently irritated the White House.
And this issue of India buying Russian oil seems to be a major sticking point for Trump, even though initially Western allies kind of encouraged India to buy it.
That's the complexity, isn't it? The core insight here is this tangled web of damaged diplomatic relations, potential geopolitical realignment, and tricky energy politics. India started buying a lot of discounted Russian oil after the Ukraine invasion. At first, Western allies were okay with it, even encouraged it, to help stabilize global energy prices. But now, it's a major source of friction with the Trump administration. Navarro's rhetoric. It could easily stir up anti-American sentiment in India, push New Delhi away from cooperating with Washington. And if India strengthens ties with Russia and China, that could really shift global power dynamics, especially in Asia.
So for our listeners.
For you, this affects global stability, potentially disrupts trade, and could even impact the prices you pay for goods if these major relationships sour.
It's truly a complex global dance. Now, speaking of global leaders and their interactions, we have a very unexpected, almost kind of surreal moment captured in China. Okay, now for something a bit lighter, maybe, but still kind of thought-provoking. Chinese leader Xi Jinping and Russian President Vladimir Putin were apparently caught on a hot mic discussing immortality. This was at a military parade in Beijing. Sam, what did they actually say?
It was a really fascinating little exchange, Lee, especially given this setting, this massive display of military hardware. Putin was heard saying to Xi something like, "You might look younger as you live, and you might even achieve immortality."
Immortality. Wow. And Xi's response.
Xi added, "Some predict that in this century, humans may live up to 150 years.
150 years. Did Putin elaborate on that later?
He did, a bit. He told reporters later that there would be social, political, and economic consequences from medical developments like organ replacement surgery that could increase significantly life expectancy.
Interesting. And yet, the topic itself was censored.
Ironically, yes. Searches for 150 years were quickly blocked on Weibo, China's big social media platform. Which, you know, highlights the control over public discussion, even on topics that seem pretty harmless on the surface.
So beyond just the, you know, the weirdness of it, what's the core insight here? What should we take away?
Well, I think the core insight is how even this kind of informal chat projects a sort of long-term vision, maybe signals national ambitions in areas like advanced biotechnology.
Mm-hmm.
Putin's comments about social, political, and economic consequences hint at these huge societal changes that would come with radical life extension, raises big questions about resources, inequality, how we govern ourselves.
Mm-hmm.
And the censorship itself is telling, isn't it, about information control. So beyond just the curiosity factor, it touches on the future of humanity, scientific leaps you might even see in your lifetime, and the really big ethical questions we as a society are going to have to grapple with as technology races ahead.
From the future of humanity, let's bring it back to the very present realities of conflict. We're turning now to Ukraine, where there seem to be some significant shifts in European and U.S. strategy. This sounds like potentially very big news coming out of Europe regarding Ukraine. European leaders have apparently agreed on military plans for Ukraine, which could even include sending troops. This follows a meeting with President Zelensky in Paris and a phone call with President Trump. Sam, what are the key elements of this agreement?
This does look like a significant strategic adjustment, Lee. French President Emmanuel Macron announced that 26 nations, he didn't name them all, have pledged security guarantees to Ukraine.
Security guarantees meaning?
Meaning things like reinforcing Ukraine's military, helping secure its skies and the critical Black Sea grain corridor. And this is the big one, deploying a reassurance force if and when a truce happens.
The reassurance force.
Yeah.
And the U.S. role in this.
That's still pending Trump's final okay, but U.S. officials have apparently told their European counterparts that Washington could provide things like additional air defenses, intelligence, surveillance, reconnaissance, ISR capabilities, maybe even help establish a no-fly zone.
And Trump himself weighed in.
He urged Europe to stop buying Russian oil and to put economic pressure on China for, as he sees it, financing Russia's war effort.
So this suggests a move towards a long-term plan for Ukraine, even if it involves difficult concessions.
That seems to be the thinking. European officials are reportedly planning for a ceasefire as basically inevitable. They believe these guarantees will give Zelensky the confidence he needs for talks that will likely involve, quote, painful territorial concessions.
And other deployment plans.
Yeah.
What would those look like? And how's Russia reacting?
The plans seem to have two parts. A demonstration element, troops stationed far from the front lines, just as a deterrent, and a regeneration element focusing on training and rebuilding the Ukrainian military.
Which countries are willing to send troops?
France and Britain are reportedly willing. Germany and some others have been more hesitant, apparently waiting for clearer US support. Russia, meanwhile, has flatly rejected any NATO or European troop presence. They've even floated the idea of Chinese peacekeepers instead, and crucially, they're still bombing Ukrainian cities.
So what's the core insight here, this renewed cooperation, this potential strategic shift?
I think the core insight is this strategic move towards building a robust, long-term security structure for Ukraine, even accepting that it might involve territorial losses. It also signals renewed transatlantic cooperation. Trump's apparent openness seems to have encouraged commitments from previously hesitant European nations, which really highlights the critical role the U.S. still plays in European security.
Even if the Trumps aren't officially from NATO.
Right. Even though it's not from NATO, the alliance is deeply involved through coordination. Leadership figures like the Secretary General Mark Rutte are involved. It definitely raises the stakes if Russia were to test this force. For you listening, these international efforts directly influence global stability, trade, and your sense of security.
It's fascinating how a political shift can unlock such significant international action. Now, speaking of political alignment having maybe unexpected consequences, let's turn to the business world, and specifically Tesla. This next story details a pretty dramatic sales crash for Tesla over in Europe. Particularly in Germany, its share of new electric vehicle registrations just plummeted from 11% down to 3.4%. Sam, what's going on here? Why the big drop?
Yeah, it's a significant downturn, Lee, and it seems to be a mix of things happening at once. The Post notes the crash happened after CEO Elon Musk, quote, cast his lot with Donald Trump, and also as the U.S. started a trade fight with the EU.
So politics is definitely playing a role.
It appears so. While, yes, there's increased competition, other car makers have caught up technologically. Stefan Bratzel from the Center of Automotive Management points to massive damage to Tesla's image, specifically because of Musk's political capers.
How so?
He mentioned that the early adopters of Tesla, often described as liberal tech geeks, weren't exactly thrilled with Musk's role in the Trump administration. It created a kind of stigma. People in Berlin are even apparently taping over the T logo on their Teslas.
Wow. Is this happening elsewhere in Europe besides Germany?
Yes. Sales also dropped by more than half in places like Sweden, Denmark, the UK, the Netherlands, Belgium. Though interestingly, Norway and Spain seem to buck that trend.
And competition is heating up too.
Definitely. New, cheaper Chinese EVs, like from BYD, are adding pressure. Europe really needs more affordable electric cars, under 40,000 euros. And European manufacturers, especially Volkswagen, seem to be gaining ground at Tesla's expense.
Musk did leave the administration back in May, didn't he? Has that helped?
He did announce his departure, yes. But it's unclear if that's really improved his standing or the brand's image much in Europe yet.
So, what's the core takeaway here about a CEO's politics impacting a global brand like this?
I think the core insight is seeing the very real consequences of a politicized brand identity. It's a clear demonstration of how a CEO's public political stance can significantly hit consumer perception and sales, especially in markets that are politically sensitive.
Right.
It also underscores how the EV market is maturing. Just having the early tech lead isn't enough anymore. Rivals are catching up, new cheaper options are emerging. For you as a consumer, it highlights how brand loyalty and your purchasing decisions are increasingly tied up with things like corporate values and the personal politics of company leaders.
That's a powerful point about today's marketplace. Okay, speaking of Trump's wars, we've heard about trade wars. Now let's turn to an environmental one, specifically against wind power. The Trump administration's opposition to offshore wind projects seems to be really ramping up. The Post reports plans to cancel permits for the New England wind project off Massachusetts. That's a project that would power something like 400,000 homes. Sam, this is a third major offshore wind project targeted in just the last couple of weeks. What's driving this aggressive push?
The scale and speed are really notable here, Lee. Besides New England Wind, they've revoked permits for a Maryland project. They issued a stop work order for a Revolution Wind that's off Rhode Island in Connecticut, and that project is already 80% built.
80% built.
Yeah, and the administration is apparently considering stop work orders for the four other offshore wind projects currently under construction.
So basically halting everything.
It looks that way. Trump himself said in a cabinet meeting he won't allow any windmills to go up. HHS Secretary RFK Jr. also criticized wind farms, citing impacts on fisheries and whales. This isn't totally out of the blue. Trump issued an executive order way back on his first day in office to halt new offshore wind permits.
But companies thought projects already underway were safe.
That seems to have been the assumption. Energy companies, investors, they figured projects already under construction or fully permitted would be okay. We're talking over $100 billion in investments tied up in just five projects. But Trump seems determined to prove them wrong. They already halted the Empire Wind Project in New York back in April.
Right, I remember that caused a huge disruption.
Cost the developer $200 million before New York's governor managed to broker a deal. And the reason given for halting Revolution Wind was vague national security concerns.
National security for a wind farm.
Crick Lippold, who actually advocates for U.S. energy security, said it's abundantly clear this administration is using the guise of national security in order to eliminate all the green energy sources it can. That points to, well, policy weaponization.
So what's the core insight, the impact of this war on wind?
The core insight is the massive economic disruption and investor risk this creates. It's being called a nightmare situation for investors. Billions in investments could be lost, creating huge uncertainty for the entire renewable energy sector.
And climate goals.
It directly undermines state and national climate targets, hinders the transition to clean energy, and it could potentially drive up utility bills for consumers if cheaper renewable options are blocked. For you, this isn't just abstract policy. It has a direct impact on your utility bills, your state's climate goals, and the whole future of clean energy development in your country.
It really is a high-stakes battle with far-reaching consequences. Okay, let's shift gears now into part three. We'll explore culture, society, and some of those daily life topics that also really shape our world. All right, we're moving away from the heavy policy debates in Washington and the global arena, turning now to the world of arts, culture, and society. We start with the sad news of the passing of a true fashion giant. This week brought the news that the legendary Italian fashion designer Giorgio Armani died at 91. His impact on modern fashion is just immense, isn't it? Sam, how did he really cement his place in fashion history? What was his signature style?
Armani truly redefined modern elegance, Lee. He burst onto the international scene, really cemented his place with Richard Gere's wardrobe in that 1980 movie, American Gigolo. Remember those suits?
Oh, absolutely. Iconic.
Totally. He revolutionized how both men and women dressed. He brought this new elegance to the power suit. He softened men's tailoring, took out the stiffness. And for women, especially women entering the workforce in new ways, he projected this understated confidence.
And he started relatively late.
He did. Debuted his first collection at 40 back in 1975. He felt bulky suits just stifled personality. His goal, he said, was to personalize the jacket, which was pretty radical then.
And his influence spread far beyond just clothing, didn't it? He became a symbol.
Absolutely. Celebrities loved him. Jack Nicholson, Martin Scorsese, Beyonce, even NBA coach Pat Riley, they nicknamed him GQ, partly because he always wore Armani suits on the sidelines.
Right.
And over decades, he built this incredible lifestyle empire. Jewelry, accessories, housewares, hotels, restaurants, even chocolates, perfumes, florists, yachts, multiple sub-labels. He's really credited with inventing the idea of modern luxury and that whole philosophy of quiet luxury, that understated look, the neutral tones.
So the core insight here is really his lasting legacy.
Yeah, his enduring fashion legacy, how he transformed the language of style, making elegance and that quiet confidence a hallmark of modern fashion across so many industries. His designs became synonymous with success, with refined taste. He shaped how generations saw professional wear, celebrity style. It really influenced fashion choices you see everywhere, maybe even choices you make.
A remarkable impact from one person's vision. Now, from the world of high fashion, let's take a really interesting turn to an exhibition celebrating a different kind of American artistry, state fairs. It sounds like fun. The Renwick Gallery has opened a new exhibition called State Fairs, Growing American Craft. It seems like a really unique and joyful look at American creativity. Sam, what kind of things can people actually see there?
Oh, it sounds fantastic, Lee. The exhibition gathers over 240 artworks. These are from artists and 4-H clubs spanning 43 states and tribal nations.
Wow. So what kind of things are we talking about?
Imagine seeing size 96 Western boots made for Big Tex, you know, the giant cowboy at the state fair of Texas. Or a life-size cow sculpted entirely from 600 pounds of butter by Sarah Pratt, who does that for the Iowa State Fair every year. Or even a full-scale John Deere tractor made out of clay by Margarita Cabrera.
That's incredible. And the Smithsonian curators actually went to these fairs.
They did. Visited 15 different state fairs as part of their research. It's tied into the Smithsonian's upcoming 250th birthday projects.
So it's really about elevating this idea of craft, maybe separating it from traditional fine art.
Absolutely. I think the core insight here is how this exhibition elevates American craft itself, shows it as this vibrant, diverse, often really profound art form. It celebrates these homegrown artists. You see incredible diversity in materials and themes, like Weaving by Linda Nez depicting the Northern Navajo Nation Fair, or Kelly Bonenkamp's corn dog vase made in the style of Delftware.
Ah, corn dog vase. Love it.
Right. It also shows how these fairs influenced major artists, like the abstract ceramicist Peter Vulkos. But it goes deeper, too. It emphasizes craft as a medium for radical ideas and activist action. There's a quilt made by prisoners in Kentucky that actually moved the governor to commute their sentences. There's crop art by a trans artist celebrating her wedding at the Minnesota State Fair. It features competitive artisans, too, like a master pickler with 700 prize ribbons.
700 ribbons. That's dedication.
It is. The exhibit runs through September 7th, 2026, and it's free. It's just a wonderful reminder of the rich creativity happening all across America, often outside traditional art galleries, and how craft can be both deeply personal and a powerful way to comment on society.
That sounds absolutely worth checking out. Okay, from artistic expression, let's pivot now to maybe a darker, more unsettling side of modern media and culture. There's a new film generating buzz called Lurker. It's described as a psycho-comedy, and it's digging into those blurry lines between being a fan and, well, obsession in the age of social media. Sounds like it might be hitting a nerve, even with the actors involved. Sam, what's the basic story?
Yeah, Lurker definitely seems to be tapping into some very current anxieties, Lee. It's directed by Alex Russell. He did episodes of Beef and the Bear. The film is about Matthew. He's a 20-something guy working retail, played by Theodore Pellerin. And he basically manages to infiltrate the inner circle of his favorite musician, Oliver, played by Archie Madekwe.
Okay, so that premise sounds familiar, maybe like All About Eve or Misery.
Exactly. It extends that genre of social climbing or stalking. But the cast members, like Zach Fox from Abbott Elementary, they're saying it feels incredibly real because of the social media angle. Fox talked about the toxic relationships and social calculations that happen constantly in entertainment and social groups. He said everyone's been on both sides, the object of affection, and also, you know, that guy.
So what makes it feel too real for them? What's the contemporary twist?
Well, the core insight, I think, is how Lurker reflects these digital age anxieties and also a kind of universal human insecurity. The director, Russell, started writing it during the pandemic. He was observing this paranoia about social calculations in LA, about the small lines that all of us cross because we want to be seen or be around someone successful or famous.
Right.
Pellerin, who plays Matthew, doesn't see him just as a creep, but as a passionate optimist, driven by this feeling of having only one chance at escaping a never-ending misery. It shows how aspiration can mask something much darker, how insecurities drive manipulation.
And Zach Fox had a pretty chilling thought about the film's relevance.
He did. He worried the film might soon feel like a quaint time capsule, because with new tech like biometric data, genome access, he said, parasocial issues look like peas and carrots compared to what's going on with Palantir and Meta.
Wow, that's unsettling. So the takeaway for the listener.
For you, it's maybe a prompt to think about your own online interactions, how your desire for connection, the information you share. How might that be perceived or even exploited in a world that's becoming increasingly transparent and maybe more vulnerable?
A very modern cautionary tale, it sounds like.
Yeah.
Okay, from the potential perils of social interaction, let's turn to the complexities of personal relationships via a particularly tough advice column question. This next one comes from Carolyn Hance's advice column in The Post, and it's a really poignant situation. A reader writes about her boyfriend, who's soon going to be her husband. Decades ago, he divorced his first wife when their kids were just in middle school and basically had minimal contact with them for 40 years, effectively abandoned them.
Wow, 40 years. That's a long time.
It is. And the letter writer, she says she's not okay with this history. She's strongly encouraged him to write to them apologizing. He apparently agrees verbally that he should, but he just doesn't do it. Sam, what's Carolyn Hax's advice in this really difficult spot?
Carolyn Hax is incredibly direct here, Lee. Her core message is, you cannot make him apologize. More important, you cannot make him apologetic by wanting him to apologize.
Oof, that's blunt.
It is. She emphasizes that his inaction, even though he says, yes, I should, is actually him effectively disagreeing with you. He won't say who he is to your face.
Meaning he won't own up to his lack of remorse.
Exactly. Hax stresses that true remorse, genuine amends, they have to come from his own initiative, from inside him. They can't be forced or coerced by her wanting it to happen.
So what's the fundamental truth Hax is driving at for this relationship, for this couple?
The core insight here really digs into personal values and relationship compatibility. Hax's bottom line is tough but crucial. If the letter writer isn't okay with what he did back then, or what he's done, or rather not done about it since then, Hax says she's not okay with the man you plan to marry. It really forces you to think about the nature of forgiveness, accountability, that amends only mean something if they're internally driven. It also speaks volumes about relationship dynamics. You just can't change someone's core character or force feelings they don't genuinely have.
So for our listeners.
For you, it's a powerful reminder about the need for self-reflection in relationships, understanding what you can and cannot change in a partner, and the absolute importance of aligning on fundamental values before you make those huge life commitments, like marriage.
Really powerful advice. Okay, we're going to shift gears now for our final section, diving into the world of sports and some key local dynamics, starting with a powerhouse performance at the U.S. Open. Right, kicking off our final section with some high-energy sports news, Aryna Sabalenka, known for her incredibly powerful game and her on-court emotion, she has blasted her way into the U.S. Open final, beat Jessica Pegula in three sets, and she holds on to her number one ranking, too. Mm. What stood out about her win?
Sabalenka's performance was pure fire-ly. Her emotion is just right there on the surface. You see the racket tosses, you hear the screams, the intense looks.
Right, she has an old back.
Not at all. But despite those displays, she showed incredible mental toughness, especially battling through that really tight third set, saving break points. She's now in her third Grand Slam final just this year.
That's impressive consistency.
It really is. And she's aiming to be the first woman to win back-to-back U.S. Open titles since Serena Williams did it back in 2012-2014. That really speaks to her athletic dominance, her place in tennis right now. For you, the listener, it's just that thrill of top-level competition, isn't it? That raw human emotion that comes with striving for greatness.
Absolutely captivating to watch. Now, turning to another huge name in sports, but unfortunately this is less positive news, Caitlin Clark, the phenomenal star of the Indiana Fever. The Post reports she's going to miss the rest of the WNBA season due to a series of injuries. She said, quote, "Disappointed isn't a big enough word to describe how I am feeling." Sam, this is a massive blow, isn't it? Especially since she was seemingly invincible in college and her rookie year.
It's a huge blow, Lee, and I think the core insight here is twofold. It highlights the intense physical toll on elite athletes, and also the immediate significant impact on a team and the entire league when a truly transcendent star gets sidelined.
Right.
Clark's injuries, they started in her second year. Left quad strain, missed 5 games. Left groin injury, missed 4 games. Now a right groin injury. And like you said, she never missed a game in college or her rookie WNBA season. It shows just how demanding the pro level is.
And her impact on the league has been undeniable.
Absolutely undeniable. Rookie of the year, first team all WNBA in 2024. Set the single season assist record, leading all-star vote better both seasons. She completely transformed viewership numbers, first in college, then carrying it right over to the WNBA. Her absence is a massive loss for the league's momentum and visibility.
What does this mean for her team, the Indiana Fever? They were looking like contenders.
It puts them in a really tough spot. They're still technically in playoff contention with a 21-20 record, but they've had a ton of injuries to other key players too. And adding another layer of difficulty, the league's collective bargaining agreement, the CBA, expires after this season.
Oh, right. Contract implications.
Big time. Right now, only Clark, Aaliyah Boston, and Mikayla Timpson are actually under contract for next season. So huge roster uncertainty looms for the Fever.
And her drawing power is immense.
Immense. Just look at Sunday's game against the Washington Mystics. It was moved to a bigger arena in Baltimore, specifically to accommodate the huge crowd expected just for Clark. That underlines her massive economic impact. For you, this story really shows the human side of sports, the vulnerability behind the stardom, athlete resilience, and just how much star power can drive a league you might follow.
Such a tough break for her and the league. Okay, from player health issues, let's look at another situation that's raising questions about the integrity of professional sports. There are some pretty serious allegations swirling around the LA Clippers involving star player Kawhi Leonard and the team's owner, Steve Ballmer. These seem to threaten the NBA's integrity. It goes back to 2019, right, when Leonard was a free agent.
That's right, Lou. Back then, Leonard's uncle, who's also his advisor, Dennis Robertson, was accused by some teams of asking for improper benefits during recruitment, things like a private plane, a free house, even part ownership of the team, stuff that's definitely against NBA rules.
And the NBA investigated that.
They did. But they closed the investigation without finding enough evidence to implicate anyone. Case closed, it seemed.
But now, new information has come out, or a new connection is being made.
Exactly. It's about connecting those past allegations to a more recent deal. In 2022, Leonard signed a marketing deal with a company called Aspiration. That deal pays him through 2026, but, and this is the crucial part, it was reportedly conditioned on him remaining an employee of the Clippers.
And then he re-signed with the Clippers.
He did. In January 2024, he signed a big three-year, $153 million extension with the team. So this whole arrangement, the outside marketing deal tied to staying with the team, is raising serious questions now about potential salary cap evasion. Some are calling it a money grab that screws over the other 29 teams.
So what's the core insight here? For the NBA's integrity, for the ethics involved?
The core insight is that this really challenges the integrity of professional sports and the principle of fair play. If these arrangements are found to violate the spirit, if not the letter, of the rules, it undermines the NBA's salary cap system, which is designed, at least in theory, to promote competitive balance.
Right. Keeps things fair between teams.
Supposedly. It also raises questions about the money over everything mindset in sports and the responsibility that wealthy owners and superstar athletes have to the overall health and fairness of the league itself. For you, if you follow the NBA or any pro sport, this hits right at the heart of fair play, the rules of the game, and ultimately fan trust.
A really critical issue for the league. Okay, moving on to local football now. The Washington Commanders made a big trade earlier this year, and they're eager to see their new acquisition in action. 6 months ago, the Washington Commanders traded for Deebo Samuel Sr., the dynamic player from the 49ers. He's heading into the last year of his contract. The team is obviously hoping he can bounce back from a tough, illness-plagued season last year and bring that game-breaking playmaking ability. Sam, what are the expectations like heading into the season opener against the Giants on Sunday?
The anticipation around Samuel is definitely highly. Offensive coordinator Cliff Kingsbury sounds really impressed. He was apparently surprised by how polished Samuel is as a more traditional wide receiver, not just the gadget player we often saw in San Francisco, you know, lining up in the backfield, taking screens, jet sweeps.
So he might have a more expanded role.
Yeah, potentially. Sunday's debut will tell us a lot about how Kingsbury plans to use him. His teammate, Terry McLaurin, called Samuel a dog, in a good way, appreciating his energy, his physical style, especially his ability to get yards after the catch. He could really add a new dimension to their offense, maybe take some pressure off McLaurin.
And what else is stirring with the Commanders as the season starts? Any other key dynamics?
Well, the core insight here seems to be around team building, new energy, and player morale. Besides Samuel, the running back situation is a bit of a mystery after they traded Brian Robinson Jr. Austin Ekeler is the starter, but how they'll rotate backs is unclear. There's a rookie, Ja'Cory Kroski-Merritt, nicknamed Bill, who's generating a lot of hype train excitement.
Always exciting to see rookies emerge.
Absolutely. And off the field, they've given the practice facility a major facelift. That seems really popular with players like quarterback Jaden Daniels, who said it shows they take care of the players. That stuff matters for morale, for recruitment.
Definitely. And on the defensive side.
New defensive coordinator Joe Witt Jr. is talking about wanting a sticky secondary, more press coverage, challenging receivers, better communication back there. So lots of changes. The success of Samuel, how these new schemes work out, it'll all directly impact their season. For you following football, it's that classic start of season buzz, anticipating a new player's impact, seeing how the team comes together.
Always a time of hope for fans. Okay, from the gridiron back to the tennis world, but this time, a very personal story from a true legend of the sport, tennis legend Bjorn Borg. In his new memoir, he's revealing something quite personal and serious. He was diagnosed with extremely aggressive prostate cancer back in 2024. Thankfully, the Post reports it's now in remission after an operation. Sam, this sounds like a very revealing book from someone known for being quite private.
It really does, Lee Borg. I mean, 11 Grand Slam titles, then that shocking retirement at just 26. He's always been somewhat enigmatic. Now he's opening up about this life-threatening illness.
And the memoir covers more than just the cancer.
Yes. Apparently it was written with his wife, Patricia, over 2.5 years. It also discusses things like past drug use, relationships, and delves into that stunning early retirement decision. It sounds like a rare, vulnerable look behind the public image.
What's the core insight, perhaps, from a story like this being shared so publicly by such an icon?
I think the core insight is the power of personal stories to raise awareness and connect on a human level. By sharing his diagnosis, his journey through treatment and remission, Borg brings significant attention to prostate cancer, to the importance of early detection.
Mm-hmm.
It also just offers this deeply personal glimpse into the life of someone many people only know from the sports pages, shows the vulnerability, the strength beyond the championships. For you, it connects to that universal human experience of facing serious illness, shared by a figure you might remember vividly from sports history. And it highlights how public figures can play a role in important health conversations.
A powerful reminder indeed. Okay, let's turn our focus now squarely to the local dynamics here in D.C., starting with crime trends, which have been such a major topic of discussion and policy lately. We've got a couple of important stories related to crime in D.C. First, the Post reports that on Labor Day, tragically, a man was killed and two women were shot in separate incidents. Sam, what do these specific incidents tell us in the context of the broader crime picture, especially given the recent federal takeover of law enforcement?
Well, Lee, while any violence is tragic, these incidents actually fit into a broader trend where homicides, specifically, are down compared to last year. That Labor Day killing brought the year's total to 104. That's actually down 17% from 124 at the same point last year.
Okay, so homicides are down. That seems counter to some narratives.
It does. And even more strikingly, the Post points out that since the federal takeover began 22 days before this report, there were four killings. If that rate held steady for a year, it would project to about 70 homicides annually. That's significantly lower than recent years. The lowest in the last 20 years was 88 back in 2012. So while violence obviously hasn't vanished, homicides have measurably decreased.
That's a really crucial data point.
Yeah.
But there's an opinion piece in the Post today that argues maybe we're focusing too much on homicide numbers. It says there's one crime trend in DC that really needs more attention. Robbery.
Right. And this piece by Thaddeus L. Johnson and Natasha N. Johnson brings up a really important core insight about public perception versus statistical reality when it comes to crime. They argue that robbery, that face-to-face crime, is far more common, more widespread than murder, and that's what really drives public fear.
Makes sense.
DC's robbery rate per capita is actually among the top five out of 36 major U.S. cities. And while it eased a bit in 2024 after surging in previous years, late last month, robberies were still up citywide compared to last year. They point out that between 2020 and 2024, there were about 3,500 more robberies than homicides and deadly weapon assaults combined.
3,500 more robberies. That's a huge difference. It explains why people might feel unsafe even if murder stats are down.
Exactly. It's the frequency, the personal violation of robbery that fuels that fear, which narratives about crime being out of control can then magnify.
So what solutions do the authors propose for tackling robberies specifically?
They advocate for a multi-pronged approach, not just relying on the federal intervention. They talk about precision policing things like a dedicated robbery suppression unit using the real-time crime center, cameras, drones effectively. Second, environmental design, better lighting, clear sight lines, making places feel safer. And third, social programs, jobs, stipends, mentoring, things aimed at reducing recidivism among repeat offenders. They also call for more transparency, like easy-to-access quarterly robbery stats by ward.
So a combination of things.
Right. It emphasizes that an effective crime strategy needs to be comprehensive, combining enforcement with prevention and community-based solutions. For you, this is about understanding what drives your sense of safety and thinking critically about which approaches are most likely to actually improve your community's well-being long-term.
A really important perspective. Now, from these broader crime trends, let's focus on a specific, deeply unsettling case that has had a profound impact on the D.C. community. Elias Rodriguez. He's the suspect accused of fatally shooting two young people, Yaron Lischinsky and Sarah Lynn Milgram, at the Capitol Jewish Museum back in May. The Post reports he has pleaded not guilty to hate crime and murder charges. The Justice Department is still deciding whether to seek the death penalty. Sam, the details of this attack are just horrifying.
They are truly chilling, Lee. The indictment lays out a terrifying sequence. It states Rodriguez yelled, "Free Palestine," while firing a handgun about 20 times. He allegedly followed Sarah Lynn Milgram, one of the victims, reloading his weapon and continued shooting her as she tried to sit up.
That's awful.
Then he reportedly entered the museum displaying a red kafia and said, "I did it for Palestine. I did it for Gaza." The victims, Yaron and Sarah, were engaged. They both worked at the Israeli embassy. Yaron Lashinsky was an Israeli citizen.
And there's evidence pointing to premeditation ideology.
Yes. Rodriguez had reportedly criticized Israel extensively on social media. He wrote a document titled Explication, where he blamed Israelis for atrocities in Gaza. He also apparently expressed admiration for that U.S. Air Force airman who tragically set himself on fire outside the Israeli embassy earlier.
This brings up the death penalty question again, especially in D.C., where it's abolished locally.
Right. And that's a key complexity here. D.C. itself got rid of capital punishment back in 1981. But it can still be sought in federal hate crime cases, which is what Rodriguez is charged with. President Trump recently said he'd like to see the death penalty for all D.C. murder convictions, though prosecutors were already weighing that option in this specific case.
So what's the core insight from this deeply tragic case?
I think the core insight is this stark illustration of hate crime, its devastating impact, and the complexities surrounding justice in such cases. It's a brutal example of violence apparently driven by ideological and political hatred, raising urgent questions about domestic extremism. And legally, it highlights the intricacies of the justice system, especially navigating the death penalty issue in a place like D.C. The case has obviously inflicted immense trauma and fear within the Jewish community and across the city. For you, it underscores the critical importance of addressing hate-motivated violence and the difficult role of seeking justice in a deeply polarized society, impacting your own sense of security and community cohesion.
A very somber case indeed. Okay, for our final topic today, let's turn to another contentious issue playing out in our schools, this time focusing on transgender policies in Northern Virginia. Five school districts in Northern Virginia, Arlington, Alexandria, Fairfax, Loudoun, and Prince William, are finding themselves in a clash with the U.S. Department of Education. The issue, their policies protecting transgender students. Sam, what sparked this conflict, and what exactly are the districts defending?
This fight seems to stem directly from President Trump's executive order titled Ending Radical Indoctrination in K-12 Schooling, Lee. That order suggested that allowing transgender students into facilities like bathrooms or locker rooms designated for females could potentially violate Title IX, the federal law prohibiting sex discrimination in education.
Okay. And then came a formal complaint.
Yes. America First Legal, which was founded by Stephen Miller, filed a civil rights complaint. They alleged that these Northern Virginia district's policies violate Title IX because, in their view, they deny cisgender students safe and comfortable use of these sex-segregated facilities.
And what are the actual policies in these districts?
The district's policies generally allow students to use the bathrooms and locker rooms that align with their gender identity.
But the education department disagrees. They found these policies do violate Title IX.
That's right. The Department of Education investigated and concluded these policies do violate Title IX. They demanded the districts rescind them and adopt policies based on biology-based definitions of male and female.
And the district's response?
They refused. They stated that rescinding their current policies would actually put them in violation of other federal and state laws that require them to protect transgender students from discrimination.
So they're caught between conflicting interpretations and mandates. What's at stake here, including potential loss of funding?
Well, the core insight is this significant legal and political clash over civil rights, educational policy, and the balance between federal and local control. Transgender students are a relatively small percentage of the student body, about 1.18% of teens in Virginia. But advocates stress that having supportive policies, including access to facilities, is crucial for their mental health and well-being.
Right.
Federal funding has been threatened. Education Secretary Linda McMahon said districts cannot openly violate federal law while simultaneously receiving federal funding. However, so far, no schools have actually lost funding over this yet. It's also worth noting that the interpretation of Title IX regarding gender identity is really split among federal courts and changes between presidential administrations. The Fourth Circuit Court of Appeals, which covers Virginia, previously ruled in a case called Grimm v. Gloucester County that prohibiting a trans boy from using the boys' restroom was discrimination.
So the legal ground is contested.
Highly contested. And the Education Department's Civil Rights Office is apparently investigating dozens of other districts and universities on similar issues, even with staff cuts. States like Maine and California are also fighting the Trump administration in court over similar policies. For you, this has direct personal and legal implications if you have children in these schools or just care about your local schools. And it reflects that much broader, often intense, societal debate over transgender rights, inclusion, and who gets to set policy for schools.
And, you know, just to remind ourselves that the news isn't all high-stakes legal battles and geopolitical maneuvering, tucked away in today's post is a headline that just, well, makes you curious. The pigeon heist.
Okay, yeah. No details provided in our outline, but that definitely stands out.
It does. You just know there's a story there, probably something quirky, a bit of human interest, maybe a nice mental break from some of the heavier topics we've covered.
Exactly. A little reminder that amidst all the serious news, there are always these unexpected, sometimes odd, sometimes charming stories that capture a different slice of life.
Couldn't agree more. It's part of the rich mix that makes reading the paper or diving into it like we do so compelling. Hashtag, #, other headlines, brief mentions. Okay, we have covered a lot of ground in detail today, but as always with a paper like the Washington Post, there are even more stories packed in there for Friday, September 5th, coming 25. We should probably briefly touch on some other key headlines just to give a fuller picture.
Absolutely. Beyond the main topics we unpack, several other significant developments definitely deserve a quick mention.
Right. For example, there's a difficult story out of Idaho. Officers who killed autistic teen in Idaho will not be charged. What's the gist there?
Yeah, that's a tragic one. The Idaho AG ruled that four officers who fatally shot a 17-year-old nonverbal autistic teen, Victor Perez, who was holding a knife, won't face criminal charges. They cited the officer's lack of awareness of his disabilities and also stand-your-ground laws. The family is now pursuing civil rights and wrongful death lawsuits, raising critical questions about police accountability, use of force, and awareness of disabilities.
Such a tough situation. And then, a big push in Texas regarding religion in schools. Texas AG intensifies push for Christianity in public schools.
Right. Texas AG Ken Paxton is urging kids to recite the Lord's Prayer in public schools. This comes alongside existing state laws requiring the Ten Commandments to be displayed and pushing for Bible-based curriculum. Opponents see it as a Christian nationalist crusade violating church-state separation, while polling shows significant Texan support for teacher-led prayer mentioning Jesus. It really taps into that national debate over church-state separation and education policy.
And in higher education news, Northwestern president to resign amid cuts to federal research funding.
Michael Schill, Northwestern's president, is stepping down. This follows the federal government freezing nearly $800 million in research funding for the university and also seeking millions to settle anti-Semitism investigations. He's the fifth university president to step down amid pressure from the Trump administration, raising serious concerns about academic freedom, university governance, and political influence on higher ed.
Wow, fifth president. Then there's the military being used domestically again. Pentagon clears way for ICE to use Chicago Naval Base.
Yes. The Pentagon approved using Naval Station Great Lakes near Chicago as a staging ground for ICE operations targeting undocumented immigrants. It could even potentially house troops if Trump orders a surge into Chicago. Illinois Governor Pritzker is strongly denouncing these tactics, while Trump has implied he'd send troops if Pritzker asked. This touches on federal immigration enforcement, military deployment, state-federal friction, and those Posse Comitatus Act questions again.
And more on the abortion front from Texas. Texas moves to allow anyone to sue abortion pill prescribers, distributors.
Governor Greg Abbott is expected to sign a bill that would allow private citizens to sue anyone who prescribes or distributes abortion pills into Texas, offering cash rewards for successful lawsuits. Advocates are calling it a bounty hunter's bill. It aims to block out-of-state providers, despite shield laws in other states, representing a new legal tactic in anti-abortion efforts and setting up more interstate legal battles.
Shifting internationally, sad news from Portugal. Portugal mourns 16 killed in funicular derailment in Lisbon.
A tragic accident. Portugal held a national day of mourning after 16 people were killed when a packed funicular car derailed and crashed in Lisbon. Investigations are focusing on a possible cable failure and brake malfunction, highlighting issues of public safety, tourism impact, and infrastructure maintenance.
And U.S. actions abroad regarding drug smuggling. Rubio says cooperation is key to no drug killings.
Secretary of State Marco Rubio stated the Trump administration will continue targeting foreign drug smugglers, even without the consent of their home countries, unless those countries cooperate. This follows a recent U.S. strike near Venezuela that killed 11 alleged narco-terrorists. It raises big questions about international law, national sovereignty, U.S. counter-narcotics strategy, and the authority given for such strikes.
Back quickly to the Federal Reserve. Fed nominee says he does not plan to resign from his role at White House.
Steven Mnuchin, Trump's nominee for a Fed board seat, plans to just take an unpaid leave from his current White House job if confirmed. This is described as an unusual arrangement and is sparking more concerns about Fed independence and potential political influence within the central bank.
From the opinion pages, one titled, "Here's a Source for Critical Minerals Hiding in Plain Sight."
That's an interesting piece by authors from the Colorado School of Mines. They argue the U.S. could meet nearly all its demand for critical minerals, things we currently rely on foreign nations for, simply by recovering them from the byproducts of existing mining operations like copper or gold mining. They discuss the obstacles like lack of financial incentive and technical challenges, but propose solutions like national sampling, R&D, and tax credits. It's about mineral security and policy innovation.
Another opinion piece challenges a common narrative. No, Gen Z men aren't special.
Yeah, Derek Thompson argues against the idea that young men are uniquely driving the right-wing shift. He presents data showing that gender polarization, men being more Republican than women, exists across all age groups, and the gap among young men hasn't actually widened significantly in recent years. He suggests Democrats might be misdirecting their focus by overanalyzing this one demographic slice.
Interesting data point. And an editorial board piece on vaccine mandates. Anti-vaxxers want to weaken state mandates. It's working.
This editorial strongly criticizes Florida's move to end school vaccine mandates, blaming pandemic-era mandates for souring public opinion and creating openings for anti-establishment figures like RFK Jr. It warns Ladapo's plan could create a petri dish for outbreaks like measles, emphasizing the public health risks of politicizing vaccine policy.
From the letters to the editor, we can't predict mass shooters.
Readers are responding to discussions about predicting violence. The letters emphasize that while risk factors are known, psychiatrists simply cannot predict which individual will commit a mass shooting. They call instead for broader public health measures to reduce gun violence, like strengthening existing laws and improving mental health support.
Another editorial board piece takes aim at an administration policy. The Immigration War Powers Gambit was an overreach.
This editorial criticizes Trump's use of the Alien Enemies Act of 1798, a very old law to deport Venezuelans, by claiming an invasion by the Tren de Aragua gang. A federal appeals court, the Fifth Circuit, ruled Trump lacks that authority, defining invasion as a military act, not illegal immigration or crime. Trump is appealing. The editorial connects this to the naval presence near Venezuela and the recent strike, highlighting concerns about presidential war powers and constitutional limits.
Then an opinion piece on a major tech case, how Google became the landmark antitrust case that wasn't.
Adam Leshinsky argues that even though Judge Mehta ruled Google is an illegal monopoly in search, the penalties imposed were relatively measured. No breakup of the company, no stopping payments to Apple. He calls it a considerable victory for Google, noting the judge acknowledged AI might inject new competition. It speaks to the challenges of antitrust enforcement in the tech world.
And finally, just rounding out the culture section mentions we touched on, Smithsonian responds to Trump push for review.
Right. Smithsonian Secretary Lonnie Bunch is initiating an internal review of exhibitions, resisting direct White House direction after Trump's executive order accused the institution of divisive race-centered ideology. It's a defense of cultural and academic independence.
Seyfried is shaking things up, refers to Amanda Seyfried's role in that experimental Shaker musical, The Testament of Anne Lee.
Yeah, a polarizing film at Venice, noted for its artistic ambitions, 70mm format, and exploring female leadership through history. Seyfried apparently went without Botox for a year for the role.
There's also this reimagined Damn Yankees confronts baseball's racist past.
A revival aiming for Broadway, updating the classic musical by making the protagonist black, connecting his story to his Negro League's father, and addressing outdated gender roles. It's about adapting classics for modern audiences and confronting history.
And a couple of other indie films reviewed, Monogamy Gets Put Through the Ringer, and a mournfully funny buddy movie about missing your other half.
Splitsville uses psycho-comedy to explore unconventional relationships and infidelity, while Twinless is a dark comedy about grief, loneliness, and identity, starring James Sweeney and Dylan O'Brien. Both sound like they're using humor to tackle complex emotional territory.
Plus, an inspirational drama gets an A for acting and a C for cliches.
That's Tina, Mother, a film from New Zealand about a Polynesian music teacher starting a school choir. Praised for the lead performance, but dinged for leaning on melodrama and cliches, classic film review balancing act.
And lastly, for our local listeners, that guide, 7 of the best restaurants around Tyson's.
Right, featuring spots like Neutral Ground for wood-fired cooking, Eric Koja for Afghan food, Peter Chang for Sichuan, and Stellina Pizzeria. just a snapshot of the local dining scene and culinary trends in the area.
Phew! What a whirlwind of headlines today. Seriously, from the absolute highest levels of government and finance, all the way down to these really personal stories of life, loss, and just the constantly shifting cultural landscape.
It's quite a snapshot, isn't it? And what's fascinatingly is how many of these stories, when you dig into them, really challenge established norms, whether it's the separation of powers or scientific consensus or even just traditional expectations in sports or relationships. Each deep dive doesn't just tell us what's happening, but gets closer to why it matters and how these changes might reflect a much bigger reshaping going on in our society.
That's a great point. It really does feel like the lines are blurring everywhere, the stakes just keep getting higher, and the connections between things that seem totally separate, well, they're becoming more and more intertwined.
And as we look back at everything in today's Washington Post, you know, the fights over tariffs, judicial independence, the deep dives into social media obsession, the push for religion in schools, it really poses a pretty fundamental question for all of us, doesn't it? In an era where so many foundational principles are being tested, what institutions, what values are you most determined to preserve? And which ones are you maybe ready to see fundamentally changed?
That is a powerful thought to end on. Thank you for joining us on this deep dive today.
My pleasure.
We really hope this exploration has given you, our listeners, plenty to think about. Until next time, stay curious, stay informed, and keep digging deeper into the stories that shape our world.